The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Improvisation at the world-famous Second City Theater. This podcast is about navigating work and life without a script. Improvisation is a practice in collaborating more effectively, tapping into your full creative potential, and building ensembles who can both support and challenge us. If you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes and share the podcast through your social media channels. Help us extend the conversation. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting the Yes And is Seth Stevens Davidovits. Seth is a New York Times op-ed contributor, a visiting lecturer at the Wharton School, and a former Google data scientist. He received a BA in philosophy from Stanford and a PhD in economics from Harvard. His research, which uses new big data sources to uncover hidden behaviors and attitudes, has appeared in the Journal of Public Economics and other prestigious publications. And he is the author of the New York Times bestselling book, Everybody Lies. Seth, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Kelly.
I'll start this conversation with the end of your book. You wrote of a study by Jordan Ellenberg, who is a mathematician at the University of Wisconsin, who is curious about how many people actually finish books. And we talk a lot on this podcast about Danny Kahneman and his book Thinking Fast and Slow. So Ellenberg found that only about 7% of the readers made it through that book. By contrast, 90% of the readers had finished Donna Tartt's novel, The Goldfinch. I'm wondering if you know how many people actually finished your book.
I don't know yet, but, you know, a lot of people now message me that they finished their book because I kind of mentioned how nobody tends to read books. That they finished my book because I mentioned how nobody finishes books, but, I don't know yet how many people, finished my book, but I'm guessing it's not too high a percentage.
Yeah, and of course, notice that I had to show off that I read the entire part of your book by starting with the end. But I was actually in conversation with Zoe Chance, who's a professor from Yale. We were both speaking at a conference yesterday, and she was saying she recommends Michael Lewis's The Undoing Project as a way for people to get familiar with Kahneman's work because Thinking Fast and Slow is so complicated and hard to read.
It's definitely a little dry. Kahneman comes from an academic background, and it's totally brilliant, but it can be a slog.
Yep. All right, so the origin story for your book is rather chilling. You note that after Barack Obama's election, there became this talk of a post-racial America. I think we all know about that. But then came Google Trends, and you discovered something altogether different from the public conversation being had at the time. What did you discover?
Yeah, so I started doing this research in 2011, and as you mentioned, people said we lived in a post-racial society. And if you ask people in surveys, are you racist or do you care that Barack Obama is black? Just about everybody says no. But I was shocked by how frequently people made racist searches on Google. People mm-hmm. were searching, particularly for the N-word. They're not typing the N-word. They're typing the actual N-word. And
wow.
People were searching with the same frequency as Lakers and Daily Show and Migrant and Economist. So it wasn't a fringe search. It was millions of searches. I thought, okay, they're searching for rap lyrics, but the version of rap lyrics almost always uses almost always ends in A, not ER. So it turned out that most of the people making these searches were looking for jokes, mocking and humiliating African Americans. That kind of got me started down this path where it seemed like there was one version of people when you asked them, and there was another version of people when they were online by themselves on Google. And I've been kind of comparing those two versions of people for the last 5 years.
And you have a line in this section where you say, quote, the location of racism was wrong. Explain what you mean by that.
That most people's idea of where racism is highest, most people think that racism is highest in the South, in Louisiana, Mississippi. If you think of our country's history, we usually divide racism into a North-South division, but What the Google searches revealed is that many of the places that were highest include upstate New York and industrial Michigan and West Virginia, Western Pennsylvania. Really, the big divide, I would say, was not north versus south. It was more east versus west, where you see it gets a lot lower in the western parts of the United States relative to the eastern parts of the United States.
So that's kind of astounding, especially given our last election. I mean, would it be too bold to say that Google predicted Trump?
That's a little bold because we don't know. I think there definitely were clues. So the biggest predictor of support for Donald Trump in the Republican primary was racist searches on Google. That wasn't found by me. That was found by Nate Silver and Nate Cohn.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's very clear that one of the reasons that Trump did so well when everybody was predicting, all the serious pundits were predicting he would collapse, was that there was a hidden racism in the United States that had been missed by the traditional sources. And these people were drawn to Trump's message. Of course, Trump started his whole campaign, his whole recent political career started by questioning where Barack Obama was born,
right?
Which many people, including me, think was a racist attack. And, he retweeted false statistics about black crime and didn't repudiate support from David Duke, the head of the KKK. So he's doing a lot of racially charged things. And it's pretty clear that that was a big part of his draw.
So one of the things that's really fascinating about this book, and we think about this a lot at Second City because I don't know if you know how we create shows through improvisation. So we essentially mine the audience for real-time insights. And they're in a darkened space shouting stuff out, and some of it offensive, some of it not. And we've actually used that process for brands so that they, kind of replacing the focus group with an audience and seeing what they respond to in terms of laughter, because we find that to be a more sort of honest way to get information. And this idea that you can make insightful discoveries through the way people search, I thought was like, I just never even considered that. And in particular, like you talk about medical searches, right, around like things like pancreatic cancer can reveal stuff that can be really useful for us in terms of, I don't know, self-diagnosis or just diagnosis of what might be ailing people.
Yeah. So there's a study by researchers at Microsoft where they looked at anonymous individual searches over time. And frequently, when someone gets a major medical diagnosis, such as pancreatic cancer, they make a search, such as just got pancreatic cancer, what do I do, or
right,
help pancreatic cancer, just diagnosed, something like that. And then they could also mine the symptoms that they had searched in the months leading to this search suggesting a diagnosis. And they found really subtle patterns. For example, if someone searches for indigestion followed by abdominal pain, that's a risk factor for pancreatic cancer. Whereas abdominal pain followed by indigestion or abdominal pain by itself or indigestion by itself are not major risk factors. And that's like a really subtle pattern of symptoms to follow an actual time series of symptoms. That's almost a radical way of doing medicine. The way we diagnose diseases now is not as sophisticated as looking at the precise series of symptoms searched by tens of thousands of people over many months. The way we diagnose disease now is much less sophisticated than that.
Wow. Similarly, there's a lot of like, oh, I thought it would go the other way with the data. So, for example, in staying in the Second City domain, you say searches for jokes are lowest on Mondays. And that's interesting because I think, people don't like going to work on Monday. There, you would think they would seek out jokes on the day where, they don't want to go to work.
Yeah, I think there's this idea that people turn to humor when they're sad. And I think that's not true. Some people do, but I think on average, people are more likely to turn to humor, seek out jokes when they're happy. So searches are highest for jokes are highest on Friday and Saturday when people are happy, and they're highest on sunny days, not rainy days. And they drop during major catastrophes, going against a common idea of gallows humor that people laugh during tragedy. They tend to seek out jokes actually less frequently during a war, after a major terrorist attack.
So this checks out for me just anecdotally, because I've worked at Second City for 30 years. I don't go home and watch sitcoms. I go home and watch like Holocaust documentaries. Yeah. I mean, there really is this sort of like, I get my humor here. Like I've got a, there's some dyad I think I need to be a part of. And this was also interesting, I thought, when you noted that search rates for anxiety are higher in like rural upstate New York than actually New York City, which goes against every Woody Allen movie or frankly any movie about New York ever.
Yeah, I think there's this idea that anxiety is highest in urban areas. New York City, I guess Chicago, doesn't have quite the same stereotype, but probably most people would think Chicago would be above average in anxiety. It's not true. The searches for anxiety or panic attacks are higher in rural areas in West Virginia and Kentucky and rural Maine, higher in upstate New York than New York City. And that's, you might say that's just because maybe people who are in these areas, they're not talking about their anxiety with their friends all day, so they need to search it more. But actually, surveys here also confirm it, that anxiety, with using many different methods, anxiety tends to show up higher in rural areas than urban areas. I think there just is, I think stereotypes, just sometimes stereotypes are true, but frequently stereotypes are wrong. So Woody Allen, you know, makes his movie about being worried about going on dates or being worried about his health or being worried about death. And we forget that a huge number of people are worried about going on dates or worried about their health or worried about death. They just don't make movies about it.
Right. Right. So the other thing that's kind of interesting about all this and this spin that you've got on the world of data, which you seem to be making a convincing argument for the vast amount of money I'm paying for my son to be an English major, because someone needs to interpret the data that's coming in. And you note that we're not always asking the right questions, that data isn't necessarily true unless we know how to read it or tell the story behind it or ask the right questions.
Yeah, I think there's an idea. I think most people think of data as an extremely nerdy, like geeky computer scientist pursuit. And I'm definitely nerdy and geeky and in computer science. But I think, yeah, I was actually a philosophy major. I do think that the skill in making sense of data, requires creativity, asking the right question, finding the story in the data. And those skills aren't so technical.
Right. There's a really cool person you introduce us to, which sort of personifies some of the technical aspects of the work that you're talking about. Jeff Sader, I think his name is, who you describe as, quote, an eccentric Philadelphia-born man with piles of degrees from Harvard. Tell us about who Jeff is and what he did.
So he's the guy. He has a few degrees from Harvard, and then he was working at Citibank when he was after graduating law school and business school, and he basically looked at himself in a mirror and realized it wasn't him. Probably like a lot of people working at Second City,
right.
They realized they can't necessarily fit in the corporate world.
Right.
So he realized that he was interested in rural life and horses. So he moved to rural Pennsylvania, and he decided to start trying to predict what makes a great racehorse great. And he basically wanted to use data to do this. This was before Moneyball, before many people had this idea that you could use data science to predict athletic performance. And for many, many years, his system he wasn't really finding anything. He was coming up with all these wacky ideas. As I said, he is eccentric and failing over and over again, but then eventually built the world's first EKG for horses and measured the size of their internal organs. He found that the left ventricle is a major predictor of how well horses perform. And he was able to predict the success of American Pharoah, who became, in 2015, the first horse in 37 years to win the Triple Crown. His EKG found that American Pharoah had a 99.6 first percentile left ventricle, and was kind of a once in a generation horse.
Wow. So like the size of an internal organ. And this was interesting, too, because you say, quote, if you are going to try to use new data to revolutionize a field, it's best to go into a field where the old methods are lousy. And that's kind of what you're saying about prediction in terms of horse racing, because that's just like whatever, right? It is like throwing money in the air. You really didn't know whether these horses were going to succeed or not.
Data recently it's not perfect, but... So if you're trying to predict something that's already great, then your new big data may not be so valuable. But if you're trying to predict something where the existing data stinks, even though the left ventricle is not a perfect measure of horse racing success, it's much better than what everybody else was using, which is basically just looking at the horses and trying to figure out, trying to guess how they perform.
It reminds me of sort of talent scouting. I got interviewed today for another podcast, and someone's like, "Man, you've been able to work with so many great. You've hired all these great talent. What did you see?" And I'm like, "I can tell you 100%. There is nothing special coming from my eyes. Really, really good people walked in the room, and most of us saw it, and we're like, yeah, they're really funny. Let's put them on stage." I would wonder where data would fit in to be able to predict, you know, the next Tina Fey, the next Amy Poehler, the next Stephen Colbert, Steve Carell.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Is there a left ventricle for comedy?
Yes, what's the left ventricle?
I don't know. Maybe you guys could share with me your data, and we could do a little study. It would definitely be interesting.
It would be cool.
My feeling is that generally there is some data can help because another of the big themes of Everybody Lies is that our intuition leaves a lot to be desired. So over and over again. You know, we think the world works a certain way, or we think that these people are going to be successful, those people aren't going to be successful, and then we find out that's just not true. And that anytime our intuition is lacking, and that's pretty much every time, then data can be really helpful.
One of the things that people, when I go give my talks about this, and that's an area I do talk about because our work at the Booth School of Business with the Center for Decision Research, we study behavioral science and improvisation. And one of the things that our scientist friends always say is we wildly overestimate our ability to understand actually what's going on in the moment. And people get interested in this on a number of levels, often about dating. And you actually talk about Northwestern scientists who studied speed daters and tried to determine what predicts a couple wanting a second date. I thought this was incredibly interesting. A woman is likely to be interested when she talks about herself. So, like, what? Yeah. How do you unpack that? What? I would think would be again. You would think it would be the other way.
Yeah, I think women don't open up always to men. This is heterosexual dating, and women don't always feel comfortable opening up. So, if she is willing to open up, then that's a sign that she likes you.
Mm-hmm. And why more questions the better?
No, it was more questions the worse, wasn't it?
Oh, was it? Was it?
Yeah, it was more questions the worse. And I think that goes against our intuition because we usually think that questions are a sign of a successful date when there are lots of questions asked. But frequently it's a sign that you run out of things to talk about, right? So you start asking, what are your hobbies? What music do you like? How many brothers or sisters do you have? That's kind of what you ask when the conversation isn't flowing.
I realize what my note was here, which is I forgot that struck me because in improvisation we actually teach you not to ask questions. That's a big thing because it's lazy, and what you need to do is be making statements and building on what other people are saying. That's how you can get something interesting. If you just end up asking questions, you're making the other person do work.
The yes and approach, right?
Yeah, exactly. So and then you actually, this is another one where you say a woman is likely to be interested when she uses self-marking phrases, such as you know and I mean, which is another one of those things of personifying yourself as a way to engage with someone else.
Interesting. Yeah, so I think you're right that I've been thinking about this a bit, you know, because I am a big comedy fan. I hoped my book was funny, but I guess I'm probably by your standards, maybe for a data scientist.
No. It was funny too. You were good.
Okay. Hey, but I am a big comedy fan, and I think a lot. Yeah, I have a whole section on what's called A/B testing, mm-hmm. which is that companies now, Facebook, Google, they run two versions of their websites. They show one group of users some version, then another group of users, and make some sort of change and see how they respond, see if they're more likely to use the site or more likely to click where the company wants them to click. And it kind of occurred to me that when I see comedy, that they're kind of the original, or you guys are the original A/B testers, right?
Right.
Because you continuously try different versions of your act and pay very, very close attention to what people are doing, whether they're laughing. To the point, sometimes, from what I understand, you tape the actual performance, so you have objective measures of laughter.
Yep.
It just struck me as a very... So in some sense, I'm not surprised that you guys have stumbled on some of the same things that data scientists have stumbled on, because I feel like you've been using the correct methodology for longer than anybody.
Right. I mean, we started in 1959. And what's interesting, too, is I've talked to some... So this all stuff was bubbling around in the University of Chicago in the 50s. And this is when, sort of all this sort of thinking was first started. And I remember talking to the micro-expressions guy, and I had no idea. He's like, oh, yeah, I ran lights for the improv shows at University of Chicago in the mid-50s. I can't say that I was actually talking to them about improvisation, but we were all reading the same books. We were taking the same psychology classes and philosophy classes. And one of the things that I tied to right away when you started to talk about this idea of digital truth serum is when you say the more impersonal the conditions, the more honest people will be. And I think that's true in a darkened comedy club. I think that you have permission to laugh at things that you would never laugh to if the lights were up.
That's really interesting. Yeah.
And it's also, there's this sort of communal response that happens when people laugh together. I don't know if you have seen that science around the idea that the part of the brain that processes an insight is the same part that processes a joke. But this idea of sort of communal laughter potentially being also communal insight, I think, is kind of an interesting area to play in.
Yeah. No, I hadn't thought of that. That is interesting as well.
And a lot of your stuff is about just this idea, and it's in behavioral economics, right? Of we're people are irrational and we're getting it wrong. And while that can be like, you're like, well, geez, how are we going to do anything? It's actually kind of liberating to know that, because it's the Kahneman thing of seeing the world as a problem, which then gives you the advantage of like trying to find the solution and being playful with it. And I think that underlies a lot of this book of like, yes, everybody lies, but don't let that defeat you. That's actually knowing it is kind of the little superpower here. It gives you freedom to play.
Yeah. No, I think playful is right. I think the other kind of connection that I would think between comedy and some of the stuff that I talk about in the book is the idea that sometimes the funniest things are the truth, right?
Right.
And I think some of the findings, obviously there's nothing funny about racism.
Nope.
But I do think that some of the findings are kind of amusing. I compare how people describe their husbands on social media when they're talking to their friends, and on searches when they're by themselves. So on social media, my husband is the best, the greatest, so amazing. And on Google when they're by themselves, it's my husband is a jerk, annoying, so mean, right? if I do that in a talk, that always gets a little chuckle. And I think there are findings like that that have kind of that similar to a good joke. They're just the truth, but they're truths that people don't always acknowledge. So.
Yeah,
I don't know.
I want to talk to you about social media, and in particular Facebook. I was at a tech conference last week, and I was having dinner, and it was one of these things where just strangers join you. And as I started to talk to these guys, they're like, yeah, we actually design a bunch of the back end of Facebook that is in the news right now. And you talk about this idea, and it's not so much about the back end, but I think this idea, and you express it this way, that Facebook exposes us to weak social connections is really interesting, and I think not unrelated to the predicament we find ourselves in now.
Yeah, well, so that was actually going against our intuition. There's this idea that Facebook creates a filter bubble, that we only see things that we want to see. For example, that Democrats will be much more likely to see news from Democrats,
right.
Republicans, or Democrats will be much more likely to associate with Democrats, Republicans with Republicans. And that's not really true. It is true that more likely your friends on Facebook are more likely than not to share your political views. But that's even more true offline. So your friends, your neighbors, your coworkers, your family members, they all are more likely than average to share your political views. And on Facebook, in many ways, it's less true because you're also associated to your weak ties.
Interesting.
To your friends with high school people, high school acquaintances that you haven't seen in 20 years, or uncles who you haven't seen in 10 years. And these people are much more likely to have opposing political views.
So would you, extending that, would you think that people were that because of the medium that Facebook is, they're not changing hearts and minds on Facebook, that maybe is not the place where that happened? Is that something that you sort of perhaps
believe? I'm getting to the kind of current Cambridge Analytica crisis. Yeah. I would say that is massively overblown.
Interesting.
I think there are issues with Facebook and, maybe some need for regulation, but I think the idea that you could figure out someone's personality from Facebook and target ads precisely based on that in an effective manner to win a political campaign, which is really what people are accusing Cambridge Analytica of doing, is, I'm pretty sure, not true. And most experts in the field say that as well.
Yeah. So I certainly see that with regard to what you write in the book, Facebook, we show our cultivated selves and not necessarily our true selves, and that we're in this bubble. I'm wondering, is there any push to action, however, right? If you think about, most people's default is to do nothing, not to vote. Most people don't vote. Could there be an algorithm that somehow would figure out the way to push you to action? That's the only thing I wonder.
They have done experiments, A-B tests, where they've shown if you show that your friends are voting on Facebook, you're more likely to go out and actually vote yourself. But the effects are pretty small.
So, okay.
It can move a few votes, but not hundreds or thousands or millions of votes.
Okay, got it. What about something like Netflix? You said that there's lessons to be learned in terms of those algorithms.
Yeah, so one of the interesting things about Netflix, I kind of talk, there's a difference between what people say and what they actually do, or they're going to do. And we're really bad at predicting what we're going to do in the future, and we tend to be overly optimistic, right? So if you ask someone, are you going to be exercising in 6 months, many people will say yes. Many fewer people actually will exercise in 6 months. And Netflix ran into this issue when they were they have the idea that you should show Netflix users not just the shows they want to watch now, but allow them to queue up the shows they want in the future.
Yep.
And initially they just asked, okay, queue up. What right now on Tuesday you're watching this. Maybe it's lowbrow comedy, but what are you going to want to watch on Saturday? When they did this, the users would be, okay, on Saturday I'm going to want to watch, a documentary about France during World War II.
Yeah.
And then Saturday comes around, they read with it, and they have no interest in watching this and use Netflix less because they hated the recommendation. So Netflix changed the algorithm to also include information on basically just building models of what people are to do based on what they've done in the past and based on what similar users were likely to do. In some ways, one of the lessons of that is that the algorithm can know you better than you know yourself, particularly when we're trying to predict what we're going to do in the future. And particularly when there's an answer of what we'd like to do in the future, we tend to be overly optimistic.
That's so interesting. The other area, too, is porn searches, right? That's the other thing you found?
Well, I have a whole section on porn. in general, including porn. I like to say that big data is so powerful it turned me into a sex expert.
Right.
Because it wasn't a natural area of expertise for me, but I study a lot of porn. That's obviously a classic example where I think you can't really ask people necessarily what they deeply desire.
Right.
Because preferences are frowned upon, So in parts of the country, for example, where it's hard to be gay, very, very few men say that they're gay, but they search for gay porn in almost as high frequency as they do in New York and Chicago and San Francisco.
Hmm.
But there are also other preferences where even people in some of the liberal areas would not admit to them because they're socially stigmatized.
Yeah, that's interesting. All right, we're getting close to the end, and I am going to ask you for a yes-and story, which we ask every guest. But before we do that, I hate Yelp. I don't know why. I guess the reason I hate Yelp is I feel like it's fake science. And you know, I'll be out with people and they'll be like, well, let's look at the Yelp reviews. And I'm like, what is that telling you? But you note, and it's Michael Luca at Harvard who said this, that one fewer star in Yelp will make a restaurant's revenues drop 5 to 9%. That's crazy.
Yeah, well, that's different from Yelp being reliable information, yeah. But it's definitely information that people take into account.
But that's it, right? I mean, there's an assumption of truth, no matter what. Like, it could be like 10 reviews, or it could be 10,000, and it's weighted the same by people.
Yeah, again, whether that, yeah, I think we are at the mercy of some of these rating systems, and they're not always so reliable. So it is definitely unfair probably for many businesses who are legitimately good but have a few low star ratings. I actually dealt with that initially. One of my first interviews for my book was with a conservative political radio station.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't really discuss some of the book. I think it's a nonpartisan book, but I do start with saying how Trump's voters are racist.
Yeah, well, that might turn some people off.
So a bunch of people bought this book and they immediately read, you know, Trump's voters are racist, and they just give me a one star and this leftist like shrill. So my rating on Amazon was like very, very low. And I'm like, uh-oh, this is really problematic.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing the research on how much people can be influenced by these average stars. And that was really, I feel unfair. It was just because the early buyers of my book tended to be conservatives who were not expecting a political message early on in the book. But eventually I basically just forced a lot of my friends to give it 5-star ratings. So I got you evened out.
Yeah. No, when I released my book, there was a fair amount of people that I didn't hire more people than I hired at Second City by a very big degree. Certainly some of the negative reviews in my book were from people I know we didn't hire. Sometimes you're a victim of that. I'm curious too, with Nir Eyal is a guy that we interviewed, and he's got it wasn't him who said it was actually someone who sent him a note that said, if it can't be used for evil, it's not a superpower. So clearly this stuff can be used for evil and is superpowered. I'm curious, like, are you ever sort of tempted to then like commercialize all this knowledge that you've got, knowing that it's almost like you have levers in a way to adjust human behavior?
I don't want to say I'm a saint, but I don't think I'm that tempted. Like, I've just always been more interested in how the world works. And you know, I've never been that in money, so I kind of feel like I make enough money with my books and speaking that I don't really feel a need. But as my book says, everybody lies, so I think you should take that with a huge grain of salt.
Okay, great. I love it.
Maybe I'm Googling searching all the time how to commercialize data, and in 10 years I'll have a business based on this.
Yeah, totally. A very dark business. All right. So I want to end the podcast with your yes and story. So as we say in our field, you know, when you have groups of people making something out of nothing, the one way to make that not work is by saying no. And you can't say yes, but you have to say yes and. You have to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. And I'm wondering if you've got a yes and story, and it could be anything from your life, from work, from your research, sometime that you yes anded.
Well, I don't know if I have a particular story, but I just think that principle is one that I need to take into account more, because basically I'm a total introvert and I never want to go out.
Mm-hmm.
And I usually enjoy going out. So I basically, my instinct when someone invites me is to say no or yes, but to shorten it or make it like a few weeks in the future instead of tonight. And whenever I say yes and instead, I guess, and you know, yes, and let's do this as well, or let's go to this place, I always enjoy myself.
That's funny.
I would put in the broad category of socializing as a place where yes and principles do help me when I use them, but I usually don't use them.
You're totally right. And while I am largely an extrovert, because I am so social during the day, and because when I was producing the theater, I'd work a lot of evenings, I would never say yes to stuff. You know, like, I just want to go home and read a book. And when I shifted into the role of more speaking dates and writing and that sort of thing, I forced myself to start to say yes to things. And I just like you're saying, like, I found myself really enjoying it. But you do, it's like, it's a push. Like, it's not where you want to go. It's like working out, you know, it's like everyone always feels great after working out. They just don't do it. So you have to figure out nudges and ways to sort of convince yourself, you know, sometimes just offer up that yes.
Definitely. And, you know, I cancel a lot. So that's kind of a, you know, so the absence of canceling is another way. Yeah. Like, is another, thing that I should do more often, not canceling and, yes. And, I guess that's another way to look at it.
That is Seth Stevens Davidovitz. The book is called Everybody Lies. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks, Beth. When I've been working in a coal mine.